Okay, next we have, we're going to stay in Atlanta, and we have Kim Workowski here, who is a professor of medicine and an expert in a lot of things, but especially STIs, and she's going to talk to us about all STIs, with the exception of syphilis, which will follow her. Doesn't mean she doesn't know about syphilis. We just split it up because it was too much to cover in a single talk. So all STIs, everything you wanted to know, except syphilis.
And Mike thought I would cut down my number of slides cutting out syphilis, but that didn't happen, unfortunately. So hopefully we'll get through all this material. If not, you got those slides for reference, because there's a lot to talk about, isn't there? So I receive research support from Gilead for HIV clinical trials and hepatitis C clinical trials. So we're going to talk a little bit about the epi, a little bit about management, and some of the trends that are happening in antimicrobial resistance. And the bottom line is it's getting scary out there in terms of what we're seeing. Those of you that are engaged in care know that you're seeing a lot of STIs. These numbers are quite alarming. These are the CDC data that looks at chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, and they're all pretty alarming. What's not on here, and I don't know if Jeff is going to talk about in terms of congenital syphilis, but the congenital syphilis is off the wall as well. The limitations, the data that CDC gets are case report data, and HPV and TRIC, which we're going to talk about, are not nationally notifiable. And as you know, most STIs are asymptomatic, so only those cases that are diagnosed are reported. And this is really, a lot of this data is influenced by how you guys are doing in terms of screening and who's reporting. This just gives you an idea. This is a data set from CDC that looks at 10 state health departments. And just to give you an idea of syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. And the only purpose of this slide is to just show you that patients with HIV have higher or the same rates of syphilis, GC, and CT. So when a patient comes to you initially, what do you do in terms of their initial care? You should get, this is just a laundry list of things to do. Most of this I hope you're doing, syphilis serology, chlamydia and gonorrhea and MSM at this site of exposure, hepatitis A, B, and C, screening for cervical pap tests per the HIV-OI guidelines, and trichomonas on their initial care visit. Now, how often should I rescreen somebody? It's really dependent on their risk, and I have the risk factors there. This is a discussion between you and the patient in terms of what their risk behavior is. And the other thing to remember is please remember the partners, and also in people that are STD frequent flyers that you see all the time for an STD, they really need prevention counseling. And think about the reason that they're having these STDs numerous times. A lot of it is due to underlying depression and anxiety. And so I link them in particular to a counselor to try to dissect out the reasons they keep having repeat episodes of STI. What about extragenital screening in women? There are no national guidelines, but we're seeing more and more. This is just an example of a study that was in CID showing that 50% of chlamydia and gonorrhea were seen in extragenital sites in women. We don't have enough data to make national recommendations yet, but be on the outlook because more and more studies are showing extragenital sites in women. So we're going to quickly move to gonorrhea. And again, I told you the rates are going up. What's very interesting is if you look at the rates by city, on the left you see San Francisco, on the right you see Florida. The difference between gonorrhea in your particular city by this surveillance system is really dependent on if you have a high population of men who have sex with men versus women. And you can see on the left, San Francisco, New York City have very high concentrations of gonorrhea in men who have sex with men, and then the South and the Midwest tend to be women and heterosexuals. There are a number of clinical manifestations most of you know with gonorrhea. This is just a laundry list. But in particular, I wanted to make sure you're aware of that extragenital infections, in particular the pharynx and the rectum, in most instances are asymptomatic. That's why we advocate screening for them. But one of the things that we're seeing is, this is a typical patient that I saw about 6 months ago. And I want to walk you through this and tell me how you would diagnose this individual. This is a 23-year-old female. She's actually 28 weeks pregnant, Gravita 4, Para 1. She presented to the OB service with ankle swelling, pain, migratory polyarthritis, and a skin lesion, a pustular skin lesion on her left finger. We actually got consulted because she had a history of pen allergy, and they wanted to know what other drugs to treat her with, because they found gonorrhea in her. And when I saw her, I was concerned that she had disseminated gonorrhea. So how would you make, what's the best way to make that diagnosis? A joint aspiration of her ankle, a blood culture, a lesion aspirate, or a vaginal swab? And I must say that the clinicians that saw this patient had no idea that what she had in her ankle was related to gonorrhea. She actually went to the OR. They called the orthopedic surgeons, and she was post-op when I saw her. The way that you normally make this diagnosis is a clinical diagnosis, and it's not through joint aspiration, blood culture, or lesions. It's actually on mucosal sites. So you actually make the diagnosis on mucosal sites. So you look a look of shock. That's why I presented this slide, because the yield from these sterile sites is much less than 50%. So you have to ask them where they had exposure, and that's where she was positive. So this patient actually had a positive urine for gonorrhea, and that's why we were consulted as an ID doc. Because she was allergic to penicillin, they were afraid to give her ceftriaxone. They didn't put two and two together that this was disseminated gonorrhea. And the reason to put this in, because in the last 6 months I've heard or seen six patients in the Atlanta area with disseminated gonorrhea. So I want to bring this to your attention, and I want to talk a little bit about this because I'm seeing more and more of it. It's estimated to account for about 0.5 to 3% of all gonorrhea infections. The traditional data shows us that the risk factors are women, menses, pregnant, and patients that have terminal complement deficiency. There's two usual presentations. One is a monoarticular septic arthritis, and the other is a tenosynovitis dermatitis syndrome. You can also get perihepatitis, endocarditis, and meningitis. Blood cultures tend to be more positive in patients that have the tenosynovitis arthralgia presentation than in individuals that present with monoarticular arthritis. And mucosal site is the way to go. However, you know if you have a positive NAT, that you don't have culture results on that. So you have to do another swab to get susceptibility tests. These are just two studies, wanted to give you an idea, a lot of data. The graph on the right is the initial paper from the French showing a cohort of patients, and what I want you to see is that the demographics are changing. Over 60% of DGI is now occurring in men. And because of what I saw in Atlanta, I asked some colleagues that run a surveillance system at CDC to start including disseminated gonorrhea in a part of an existing surveillance system. And this just shows you from 2 years, 26 patients were identified in two areas. One was California and one was Georgia. And again, the majority were men, including men who have sex with women and MSM. And look at the age. 30% of them were over the age of 45. So I think the demographics are shifting, and I really want to make sure that you're aware of this interesting presentation. What about treatment? This is a very wily bug, and over the last 60 years, it's developed numerous ways to develop resistance to antimicrobials. This gives you an idea of some surveillance data that CDC uses to help them define treatment recommendations. And what you can see over the years is that there's been a little bump up of the cephalosporin MICs that kind of peaked around 2011. And then since 2014, there's been an increase in azithromycin MICs. And what you see there on the right is that this is occurring a little bit more commonly in men who have sex with men than in women and heterosexuals. However, there are no isolates as of 2017 in the United States that had resistance both to azithromycin and ceftriaxone. As you know, the recommendations in the United States are to use two drugs for treatment of gonorrhea, and there is no overlap here in the United States. However, on your left, you see the difference in terms of treatment recommendations. There are some draft recommendations now from the UK that they've gotten rid of dual therapy, and they've increased their dose of ceftriaxone to a gram. The Europeans are still recommending dual therapy, and Japan has been recommending for a number of years a gram. However, this is the difficulty with designing regimens. That think about the different sites. The extragenital sites are somewhat special because they have different kinetics in terms of antibiotics penetrating to the area. The kinetics of ceftriaxone and azithromycin are very different from an antibiotic standpoint. One has a long tail, one is very short-acting. And a lot of the times what happens is if you even have ceftriaxone in your office, you can administer the ceftriaxone, usually don't have the azithromycin. You think the majority of patients go and get their azithromycin that day? Or do they go the next day or when it's available to get that second dose? And so what happens then is you have that long tail with azithromycin, which can last 3 to 4 days. So also that the bacterial burden may be different at different sites. As I mentioned, you tend to be more asymptomatic in the throat and the rectum, lower bacterial burden. There's two new drugs that have been looked at in phase two studies. There's more to come in terms of phase three studies, but there's at least some new drugs on the horizon. What about treatment failures? As I mentioned, none here in the U.S. However, there was a report a couple of years ago of resistance in the New England Journal of Medicine in the UK for dual therapy. And just recently, a couple of months ago, there were several isolates reported from the UK and Australia of resistance to both ceftriaxone and azithromycin. So it is coming. It's just not here yet. So what are we doing to help with this? The WHO has launched this initiative, which is looking at a plan going forward. And if you're interested, you can look at that article in PLOS Med, but there's a timeline now of thinking about what we need to do worldwide and coming together with experts from all over to think about what we can do for gonorrhea, because this is just a matter of time before we get this organism here in the United States. Chlamydia. Again, nothing new. Rates going up, both in men and women. Overall, we've seen most of this increase in women, and the reason for that is because women are screened more than men. There's no screening recommendations for men unless you're a man who has sex with men. There is a significant disparity in terms of race, and there's also, it tends to occur in women under the age of 20 to 25. So what's new in chlamydia? So in terms of what's new in chlamydia, these different presentations, you may have heard of lymphogranuloma venereum, which is caused by a strain of chlamydia L1, 2, or 3, tends to cause inguinal lymphadenopathy. What a lot of people don't realize is sometimes you can start with a penile ulcer, and then it resolves, and then you get these draining buboes. But what we're seeing more commonly is LGV proctitis. The picture you see there is a colonoscopy, and this patient presented to the ER with rectal bleeding. And what happened was he went down the path of going to the getting scoped and going to the GI doctor, And he got a biopsy, and the biopsy looked histologically like Crohn's disease, and he was treated with steroids and didn't get any better. Histologically, LGV can look just like Crohn's disease. So how do we diagnose it? A swab on the tissue will show it's chlamydia, but then you need to do a genotype to determine that it's LGV. You don't wait for the genotype to come back. You empirically treat them with doxycycline for 3 weeks. There is some new data that we may be treating too long. The UK has looked at shorter course therapy, and it's shown to be effective. But the recommendations here in the U.S. are still for 3 weeks of doxycycline. And several years ago, there was a report in an HIV clinic of an outbreak in Michigan. And the reason I bring this up is because the presentation was penile ulcers. So two of these patients presented with penile ulcers, and then look at the other concomitant infections that these men had. 16% had acute HCV, 11% had acute HCV, 16% that was their initial diagnosis for HIV, 16% had syphilis, and then a minority also had gonorrhea. So again, you find one STD, you look for others. These two charts were what happened with LGV outbreak that was seen in New York City health departments, and this was just recently going to be recently published in STI. Most of these were occurring in individuals that were young. There were racial disparities. They were HIV positive. And you look at the LGV incidence from 2013 to 2015. So it's going up. We don't have a point-of-care test that we're able to diagnose this. You basically diagnose this on the basis of the rectal bleeding and the proctitis. You send your test. The test then gets sent to the state to do genotyping, and you treat empirically. What about treatment recommendations? So initially we got a glimpse from these patients that had non-gonococcal urethritis. What you see there on the left is three trials of non-gonococcal urethritis. And what you start to notice was there's a decreased effectiveness of the azithromycin. And that's been borne out in subsequent meta-analysis, especially in male chlamydial rectal infections. And so we've seen a number of cohort studies and retrospective studies that have shown us the same thing. There's now an ongoing trial through a sexually disease-transmitted clinical trials group where we're actually looking at asymptomatic infection to definitively answer azithromycin versus doxycycline. So in the recommendations are that if you've got a patient that you should consider with rectal chlamydia, you should really consider doxy over azithromycin based on some of the case report and retrospective data. And then remember to retest. There's a high prevalence of reinfection, so you want to retest within 3 months after infection. HPV. The most common STI, the majority of sexually active persons will become infected. Let that wash over you. Initially, most persons have no symptoms. Anogenital warts, low-risk HPV types, rarely cause cancer. High-risk HPV types, in particular 16 and 18, may cause anogenital and oropharyngeal cancer. However, most of these infections clear within 2 years. The minority develop high-grade lesions, and we know that high-grade lesions can progress in terms of cervical cancer to 1 in 80. There is a linear line. We don't have that data for men who have sex with men. How common is high-prevalence HPV? And this study is really interesting. Just came out in the Journal of Infectious Disease and looked at the sexual preference and HIV infection were strong independent predictors of having HPV 16. But just having that in your rectum doesn't mean you're going to develop cancer. It's just higher prevalence in these particular gentlemen. This graph shocks a lot of people. Most people talk a lot about what programs they have for anal cancer and cervical cancer. They don't talk about oral cancer. So this is an MMWR that just came out earlier this year that's showing that oropharyngeal cancer in a male is going way up. It's the most common HPV-associated cancer. This is just for you to read, not here, because it's too small, but to remind you that there's guidelines for testing, right, in terms of women. How you should, your cervical cancer screening, and that you can now go with women that have a normal pap smear, they can go to an every 3 year combined test with a pap smear and an HPV test for women over the age of 30. This is just to remind you, all the nuances are there, this is just there for your reference. What about in men? So in men, we don't have that clear linear relationship yet, in terms of going from AIN1 to anal cancer. What can happen is things can go back and forth and sideways. So you can get reinfected. So you can be from normal to have an abnormal pap smear and then go back. And then you have a new partner and then you get reinfected. So I wanted to take you through some of this and think about what are the tools that we currently have. We've got primary prevention, which is vaccinating people before they become sexually active. Adolescents and catch-up vaccines in adults, which is less effective. What about if you've got somebody that's already got an abnormal anal cytology? Screening and treatment, there's no national recommendations at this point for screening and treatment in terms of anal pap smears. Most individuals that are going to have abnormal pap smears, they have to go to get anoscopy. Do you have a program that's able to do that? Is your colorectal surgeon interested? Usually there, so you have to have your infrastructure there to be able to do that. But I will just say that ablating a cervix is a lot different than ablating a rectum in terms of complications. So think about what the endpoint, what you're trying to achieve. There are investigational therapies being looked at, immune modulators, antivirals, therapeutic vaccination. So we're kind of not there yet. Most of the, if you're interested in this, most of the information really should be done through a clinical trial or if you have an existing infrastructure to look at to see, are we making a difference? What about the vaccine? I mentioned the quadrivalent vaccine has gone away. What we've got now is a nanovalent vaccine. It's approved to prevent warts, cervical, vulvar, vaginal, and anal cancer. And I list the doses for you. In HIV-infected individuals, they still get 3 doses. They don't qualify for the 2 doses. It's still they need 3 doses of vaccine. What have we done in terms of cervical cancer in women? Or this is actually looking at CIN in women. And what is really interesting is you can see all the lines going down for the 15 to 19 and the 20 to 24-year-olds, okay? So the CIN is going down. We've been a little slower here in the United States to adopt HPV vaccine, and I'll show you some data with the Australians that are just remarkable. In Australia, pretty much genital warts and visits for abnormal pap smears has gone away. This is some data, again, looking at the herd effect. This is before they started school-based vaccination for HPV vaccine in boys. They did it first in girls, but what you can see here is this dramatic decrease even in heterosexual men, dramatic decrease even before they started vaccinating, just by vaccinating the girls. Didn't show much of a benefit in looking at gay men or bisexual men in terms of use of vaccine. The first data that we had in terms of gay and bisexual men here in the United States showing the benefit of vaccine, which you see what's circled in red there about prevention of AIN1 and 2, a 74% efficacy was demonstrated in this trial a number of years ago. However, just recently, Tim Wilkin, and this is a lot of numbers, but what I want to get you to here in terms of the efficacy of anal infection, look at this. This is in HIV-positive adults greater than 27 years. It's not that great, 35%. It was more effective, however, in terms of oral infection, anywhere from 58 to 66% effective. So, again, we don't have the current recommendations for vaccinating over the age of 27, and we don't know really the reason why, in terms of maybe they probably, we were thinking probably because they've been exposed to multiple types. We just don't have the full explanation yet. So in terms of tertiary prevention, does screening, high-grade AIN, prevent anal cancer? There's a study ongoing trying to answer that question, looking more about the natural history. And what they're doing is they're looking at individuals that have abnormal pap smears, both men and women, and doing a rectal exam versus active monitoring with ablative therapies using infrared coagulation, electrocautery, and then ablative therapies to the rectum. We'll know in about 2022. We just don't have that information yet in terms of rectal cancer. Trichomonas, the most common STI worldwide. Nobody cares about it. It doesn't get any press, but it's the most common STI. I actually think it's fascinating. It's really interesting to look at under the microscope and see its little flagella going across the slide. And what you see here is vaginal epithelial cells and the little organism here attached to vaginal epithelial cells. This is actually from Science, so at least Science thought it was pretty cool. I actually think it's a fascinating organism. It causes a variable spectrum of disease, both in men and women. And audiences are usually shocked to know that it can cause infection in men. It can cause non-gonococcal urethritis in men. And it's very geographically dispersed around the country. It seems to be much more common in the South than it does in the colder areas of the country, and it's because Trichomonas doesn't like the cold. It likes to be warm. And so why is it important to you, to this crowd? It's because Trichomonas, there's an increased risk of transmission and acquisition of HIV infection. Older studies show it's linked to adverse pregnancy outcomes and low birth weight. And that slide looks messed up on the left. Suffice it to say that depending on what population you're looking at, it has a very high prevalence. There's also a very much of a ethnic disparity between looking at Trichomonas. It's probably got one of the highest ethnic disparities than all the STDs. And it's the only STD that goes up with age. A lot of numbers here as well, but what I'm showing you here is just look at this column here. This is looking at males and females, comparing trich, chlamydia, herpes, and HPV. Again, trich doesn't get any respect. I'm just saying. This is a recent meta-analysis that was done looking at risk of HIV acquisition, increased risk of all putting all these studies together 1.5 times. So it is important in terms of HIV acquisition and transmission. So what should we do for trich? We should screen at their initial visit. There is data from 1999 that there are differences in treatment whether you're HIV infected or not. So you should be treating Trichomonas with 500 milligrams twice a day for 7 days in HIV infected patients. However, there was just some recent data also published presented at a meeting and published, showing that I think we're going the same way in individuals that are not HIV infected. So I think that this may be changing in the future. There's only one drug class, nitroimidazole, either metronidazole or tinidazole. If you have a patient that can't tolerate those medications, it's somewhat challenging in terms of getting them either desensitized or there's some intravaginal options. There are clinical treatment failures. 5 to 10% of people fail therapy, and they're miserable. Retest 3 months after you treat because there's a high incidence of reinfection. And what do we do in individuals with persistent infection? make sure that their partner's been taken care of. I talked about this 4 to 10%. And if you still can't get your patient taken care of, you can send the isolate to CDC, who will do susceptibility testing and give some advice in terms of how to manage your patient. So lastly, CDC puts out recommendations for STI screening and management. I want to point out that in this guideline, there's also recommendations in there for screening and who you should screen. You can actually download, put the app on your phone, so you can get all that treatment information. It's not the whole tome of the document, but it's just the pertinent treatment. And then also wanted to give a mention to this network, which is really helpful. So if you've got a really perplexing case and you don't know what to do, you can't find culture media, you've got a resistant trich case, there's a clinical training and consultation network that you can actually, it's a warm line where you can actually talk to a person and get some advice on what to do. So I would recommend that you would use that. We know that there's a lot of problems out there. STDs are very high, and it's a great resource for you to use. And I also give a shout-out to my former cubicle mate, David Spock, who created an absolutely wonderful curriculum for people to use. If you want to learn more about STIs, he's created this wonderful curriculum. And it's great in terms of self-study, modular learning, and you can get CME credits for it. So I can't believe I finished on time. Bravo. Oh, my Bravo. God.
It's because you took out the syphilis, that one syphilis slide.
No, great.
Thanks so much, Kim. Great job. I want to introduce you to this guy. This is a looks like cute and everything, but it's a treponema pallidum. So I'll just leave it up here. We can pass it around if you'd like. Okay. Invite you to come up to the microphones, et cetera. And I will add that that's another question that a lot of people missed on the pretest is what Kim went over about GC and disseminated GC. Most people said culture the aspirate from the ankle. Check the mucosal site. That's the take-home point.
All right. Yes. Hi. I had a question about mycoplasma genitalium and whether we'll be able to start having standardized ways of testing for it. And the other thing was about EPT, whether it makes me nervous to use cefixime for EPD for gonorrhea and whether we're going to be looking at starting different guidelines for that soon.
Two great questions, and unfortunately, you don't know how hard it was for me not to put sneak a mycoplasma genitalium question in. But hopefully I can get to that in the workshop, but I tried to stick to what they told me to talk about. So the issue in terms of, for those of you that are not familiar with mycoplasma genitalium, it's an organism that causes about 20% of non-gonococcal urethritis, and probably about 5 to 10% of cervicitis. We don't have a commercial available test yet to detect mycoplasma genitalium. There was a study that was just done by a certain manufacturer that is submitting that information to FDA. And so hopefully the plan is we should be able to have something, I hope, by 2019. That we should have an assay. The problem is once we're able to test for the organism, what are we going to treat with? Because there's a big problem right now with emerging resistance to mycoplasma genitalium. The recommendations as per the STD treatment guidelines are still for azithromycin. There are other places around the world that are doing other, kind of having other approaches. That's a whole nother discussion. But it is hopefully going to be available, I hope, by 2019. Your question in terms of EPT, so the recommendations for EPT, struggling with that because the question is, do you know that even though that cefixime is not recommended as a recommendation anymore for the treatment of gonorrhea, if you have no other options, that's what the STD treatment guidelines say. So if you have no other options, you can't get that partner in and to get an injection, rather not the, we would rather them get a treatment that is maybe not 95% effective, but maybe 90% effective, that they can actually take it versus having untreated gonorrhea. So that was the thought process.
Okay, so we'll do kind of quick questions and answers, Steve.
Hi, thanks. That was a great talk. Quick question about screening for trich. So when we sort of push out in all these trainings about, you know, always screening for GC, chlamydia, syphilis, hep C, sort of based on exposure, mm-hmm. we should probably add trich to that now that the technology is such that it's almost equivalent.
So
equivalent
that's
a, to the sensitivity.
So it's
of the
a
others.
It's a great question. There was a paper by Brooke Hoots, and if that may be you may be interested in why trich isn't reportable, but it will get to the answer of your question. And the issue is that epidemiology is very different. What basically the STD treatment guidelines say is that we would test for it in individuals that come in for vaginal discharge or want to be tested for STDs. So in terms of screening the general population, what we don't have in terms of the public health benefit, the cost-benefit ratio of screening a large population, you at your own institution can make your own decisions. But in terms of national recommendations, that was the reason why.
It just seems to me like with the technology such now that we can do it so much more easily than we could before, we may see the same explosion we saw when everyone started screening with the probes and everything.
So what we do at our institution is you can do it either alone or you can bundle it with chlamydia and gonorrhea. It's just mentioning again that the epi is different and that's why the decision was made, do we can either bundle it or do it trich alone.
Thanks. Do you see any implications of the increasing azithromycin resistance among GC for neonatal prophylaxis?
Neonatal prophylaxis for?
For neonatal ophthalmia.
So the recommendation is for erythromycin. So that is going to be revisited. As you may know, that the Canadians actually don't do that anymore.
Right.
So the recommendation was made a couple of years ago. The Red Book, and I just talked to them a couple of months ago in terms of the Red Book committee, and they talked about this. They had a large consultation in terms of trying to make a decision about this, and they still decided that it's still going to be a recommendation in the Red Book. The next version of the treatment guidelines will be revisiting this in terms of what we should do. And I think your point is an excellent one because the resistance in terms of GC resistance is about 30 to 40%. So in terms of it doesn't make sense when you look at the surveillance and the epi. The other problem that happened, remember years ago when we had the problem with erythromycin shortage, and we didn't have another option for what people to do, for what to put in the eyes. People were using gentamicin, that was the next go-to, and there was a whole bunch of problems that happened with burning kids' eyes and having ulcerations. The difficult problem is that gonococcal ophthalmia can cause blindness.
Right.
Okay, it's a serious thing. A lot of the states, even if CDC comes out and change the recommendations, a lot of the states have it in their mandates. So you would have to go by and change state law. Because all the states basically say it needs to be done. So you not only if CDC comes out and makes change recommendations, the states would have to go back and change their recommendations.
Okay.
Thanks.
Let's see how many we can get through really quick. So quick question.
Yes, quick.
Answer.
So thanks for talking about trichomonas first. But my comment was about HPV and the FDA expanded recommendations to age 40, I mean, expanded access to 45 years of mm-hmm. age. Will the recommendations catch up to that, particularly in HIV where we see such a high prevalence of HPV?
Well, remember I showed you that paper. So that was not an HIV-infected individual. So that paper that just came out showed that the efficacy was very poor in HIV-infected individuals with greater than age 27.
Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Any pearls on how to take care of a person who is severely allergic to metronidazole and has trichomonas?
Yeah, so that's the call I get all the time. So you have two options. The two options are either desensitization, either IV or PO, and then there's a drug that you probably never heard about, or you may have,
yeah.
Peromomycin. And you can never get it. And if you need to get it, I can help you with where to get it. It's a non-absorbable aminoglycoside that you have to make compounded. And you have to, there's an initial paper back in 1997 about how to compound it. And it irritants and it can cause ulceration. It works less than 50% of the time. Option number two is boric acid. There's a case report in the literature of using boric acid, 600 milligrams BID, for at least 28 days. One case report in the literature, okay? And then the third option is betadine. So we know betadine works. We don't know how long. We don't know the concentration you need. We tried to do a study a couple of years ago using a betadine pessary, but we couldn't find anybody to fund it. So we know betadine works. So there's three.
Excellent. Thanks.
Okay. Right. We've got to keep it quick. Let's go here. Go ahead.
Just wondering what would make you clinically, if you're dealing with somebody with chlamydia proctitis, what would push you to treating for LGB while you're waiting for typing of the chlamydia, if you can even get typing of the chlamydia?
So if they're symptomatic.
Correct.
So if they're symptomatic, they all get treated for LGB.
Okay,
so if they come in with proctitis, they should all get treated while you're waiting. For 21 days.
All right.
The asymptomatic, the issue that I was telling you before, the decision, the azithromycin for the doxy, that's really for asymptomatic patients.
So really, if they're not asymptomatic, you're treating for 21 days
yes,
for rectal
ma'am.
Chlamydia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about Solosec, the new Izole that's being used for BV. I saw it on the slide, but
you mean
I wasn't.
Cycnidazole.
That's right.
So we have no data in terms of trick.
Well, because it's hard to get people to take those BID metronidazole.
Yeah, we have no data.
Yeah.
This is more of a comment than really just a question. It's about anal dysplasia screening. So at our clinic, we do anal paps in men over 30. But I did just want to mention that we have had three cases of women who have never had receptive anal intercourse mm-hmm. with anal cancer, and then we've also had a 23-year-old with invasive squamous cell carcinoma with mets to the liver. So it's just something to consider that although there are not guidelines and that the anchor study data will not be released for 4 more years, that it's something we really need to do a really thorough digital anal rectal exam and refer to colorectal if there are abnormalities.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and it would be interesting to see in terms of the programs that do have a comprehensive screening program, how many are including women. I know at Emory, the person that's running our clinic actually is an OBGYN that's actually running the male, anoscopy clinic, and it's actually seen, women from the clinic as well.
Okay, I'm going to go just a minute or two longer just to get to some of these. We'll do it very fast. So, partner treatment for TRIC, yes
Same.
Or no?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Okay, good. Can you give metronidazole 2 grams one time instead of for 7 days for TRIC?
What I just said was for in HIV-infected individuals, it should be 500 BID for 7 days. There's a clinical trial that shows it's superior. And then for non-HIV-infected patient, we have some data that I think we're moving it for it for everybody.
Why does the incidence of TRIC go up with age?
Don't know. Probably because, my thought is because it can migrate out and it can be in the perivaginal and periurethral glands and be asymptomatic and just sit there and do nothing. So you get a woman that's 60 that has a urine and they see TRIC swimming and they say, what the heck? Where did this come from? I haven't had sex in 30 years. It can sit there and do nothing for years and decades.
It's exciting. who should you do anal paps on? There's sort of a follow-up to that last question. What's your rule?
So every clinic is different in terms of the anal paps. What there are no, as I mentioned before, there are no national recommendations in terms of anal paps in your screening. What I think, my own personal opinion, where I think things are heading, anything in the rectum numerous times, you're going to have an abnormal pap smear. So the point is, if you're having anal sex, if you're putting things in a rectum, whatever it is, you're going to have an abnormal pap smear. So what do you do from there? The issue is there's not good data that correlates an abnormal pap smear and the AIN grade. So I think where we're going with this is biomarkers in terms of turning on of the HPV gene, similar to what's being done in terms of colon cancer. So if the gene turns on, that's what we're more interested in. So to me, that makes more sense than sticking swabs to do an anal pap smear or to do HPV typing.
Okay. Two quick, I can't get to all of them, but this one is about suffixing 400 milligrams instead of ceftriaxone for GC.
So I think what we mentioned, she was mentioning before, the question over here was about EPT. Suffixing should not be used at all except in instances where you cannot bring a partner in to get a ceftriaxone. So it is only recommended in instances of EPT, not as recommended treatment.
And the final one, just the nuances of oral pharyngeal chlamydia testing and when to do it or how do you interpret it for NATS.
Yeah, so the issue is that this is what's challenging. There's a sizable proportion, probably about 30% of individuals that can have chlamydia in their throat that can spontaneously resolve. The problem is that they can transfer that to somebody else's urethra. So that's the bottom line.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay. Great job.